Well, walking back from the Giardini on the last evening here in Venice, I happened to have bumped into Vanessa Beecroft, which is very nice. But Vanessa, I understand that you are actually making a performance at the Guggenheim collection tomorrow evening. Sadly, I won't be here for it. It's called VB47, but can you start by actually, I mean, we know your work, but can you describe exactly what you're going to be doing at the Guggenheim space tomorrow night?
I was invited at the last moment by Nicolas Elion, that is a nephew of Peggy Guggenheim, that lived in the collection when he was a kid. And I immediately, since I was raised not far from Venice, I've been brought to the Peggy Guggenheim collection all my childhood. And I had some de Chirico or Magritte in mind. So when he asked me, I thought to do a performance of nude girls with no head. And for that, I asked a British designer, Philip Tracy, to design hats that look like eggs. So that would make the girls look as if they had those headless sculptures and paintings of the Chirico. And another British designer, Alexander McQueen, to do shoes that look like if they were not wearing any shoes, but just on their toes. So that was, at the end, will be tomorrow, at 20 nude girls you cannot see their face. Mm.
So what actually is covering their face? You say an egg shape.
It is two half eggs, kind of circle, with a web for which the models can see you, but you cannot see their face. And they will be nude and very beautiful because Italian Vogue helped me to cast Eastern Europe models. So we had to concentrate a lot on the body since you cannot see any expression.
Why have you covered their faces?
Because I like the idea of the equivoc between them being headless, without a head, and at the same time corresponding to a metaphysical period that is very well represented in the collection. And so to play the game between the live girls with no head, the fashion accessory in which you don't have to show your face, or maybe you don't even have one, and then the reference in paintings. And one reference that I really like is the return of Ulysses of the Chirico, in which a man is rowing a boat in a room. And it's 1968, and he was just painting something that is completely not of the time. I remember that time there was all the revolution, and the Chirico was there painting references to Ulysses and domestic environments. So
this is really the third time that we've spoken, and you've spoken to Audio Arts Magazine. The first time was Cologne Art Fair, quite a few years ago, in
1994.
And then last year at the Gagosian Gallery, where you had the red-headed blonde girl standing naked, and we'd made an interview with you. This isn't the third time we've spoken, it's the fourth time, because we did speak in the 1997 Venice Biennale, actually. Is there a sense in which, I mean, I just wondered if you could talk about how the work might have developed during that period. Is there a thread that's kind of evolved or changed?
The real thing is that I finally feel authorized to use the girls as a material. While before, in the fur performance with the yellow hair, I had to emphasize certain aspects to make them look like they were fake. And now in London, it was a mixture between fake and real red-haired girls. And now they don't even have a head. I have the opportunity to shape them and color them as if they... it's my material. It has been approved from the audience.
Let's talk about that, though. What do you mean? There's two things. Using the girls as a material is the first question, and the other question is your reference to its being approved. What do you mean by both of those things?
That before, there is a lot of sensation generated by the girls themselves that is very related to what they actually represent in real life, pin-up or fashion, and I need to have them blank as if they were a plain material. And that it took some time, because my reference from the past were painting and not really fashion or these other subjects. So now I feel more able to, I've been more authorized to be using girls to be, so that the girl, it's not a big surprise to use them again, so that I can now do variations and go more into paintings that are composition things that I was more interested in.
But when you say authorized, who has authorized you?
The people, since they let me do more performances, I think then I can keep doing more without the big deal of being girls or naked or heels. Apart from that, then I can go and do other more in-depth. But I think I will always use them at the end.
I think we probably even spoke about this in our first interview, but it's something that people say to me when I talk to you, that but she uses these beautiful models all the time. I mean, is there a sense in which you might use other kinds of people that have different kinds of appearances that aren't beautiful in the kind of classic sense of the way in which media presents women?
I actually started, for example, in this last piece, maybe they will be actually very beautiful, but in the past I've been casting students, girls in the street. The look is always a bit standard. The dimensions are never too big or too small. The height is always a certain height, because my reference is not about typology or sociology, but it's really also about beauty. But the beauty that is not going to last, it's ephemeral, that is miserable because they have to stand and you feel that they're not glamorous. There is no glamour in a performance, maybe in a picture, but not in the performance itself. So I need to have certain standards. They cannot be too big or too small. It would be too much about the typical, and that is to commedia dell'arte. I can't stand it.
When you say it would be too much about the typical, but have you considered working with the non-typical, the atypical, women that don't have these kind of classic proportions, people that have a little bit more weight?
No, because that would be more about fitness than if they didn't. And also it is not, it doesn't give you the same melancholy and sense of beauty and the decadence of beauty that does a real beauty. And anyway, again, I confirm, if you go through the book, the pages of the book, you can see they're not really beautiful. They are about beauty, but they're never, I don't feel I ever had a really beautiful model to work with.
As I won't be here to see the performance tomorrow night at the Guggenheim Collection or Guggenheim Museum, however you like to call it, could you describe for us who won't be there, who can't see it, what exactly will happen?
In the main hall, where Magritte is at the end of the wall, there will be 20 women installed, and they will be all the same, and they will be standing on their toes, and their face will be hidden by this egg-shaped hat. And for 3 hours they will be still and standing and sitting and deambulating in the room slowly, and that will be the picture, in a relationship with the picture that are hanging there, the collection.
So, I mean, the other final question is really about the Venice Biennale, because, what's your feeling then about involvement in the 2001 Biennale as a context for making your work?
It is a must to be at the Biennale. In a way, it's okay to be there, it's great, but I really feel involved when I have a performance and a museum and a space. So I presented here work that I never showed before, and it's a project with it's a calendar that I realized with my British sister, half-sister, in which I colored her every month in a different tone. But so I'm very flattered to be in the Biennale, but yet I feel it's, I don't know. What I was thinking is, it's very old for me. It's very old art. I didn't feel that it was anything really strong and aesthetic here that is outrageous or that change of view. It was something.
In the actual gardens, Giardini.
I didn't have time to see much. I only saw three pavilions, British, French, and American, so I have to go back. They told me the Canadian and Korean are very beautiful, but I haven't, and German, but I haven't seen them. But in the Arsenale, I felt as if I was in an Academy of Arts, School of Art.
So So again, another fortuitous meeting. Angus Fairhurst, met you in Venice at 2001 Biennale. Can you say why you're here?
Well, I'm mainly here because a friend of mine is doing the Korean Pavilion, Michael Ju. And since I met him in 95, we stayed in touch, so I thought it was a good time to come and support him. But I also came because of the phenomenon of Venice. I've never been before. I'm a Venice virgin, so I wanted to see what all the fuss was about. And got one of those cheap flights out of Stansted, and half of the plane is full of other members of the various capacity London art world, and you just kind of keep secretly wishing for some sort of air disaster, but anyway, it didn't happen.
Well, two things. One is you come here to support and be involved in Michael Jube's intervention here in Venice. Can you talk a little bit about that before we talk about Venice?
There's a big tree cut into many sections, and at the moment of exploding, in a way, lots of steel rods holding the sawn-off sections. So more or less forms, still holds the shape of a tree, but is on the point of disintegrating. And there were other some other elements also in the show, an exploded elk antler and a family of bronze who are on a bridge looking into the future pissing.
Is there anything you want to say about, though, the Biennale as a manifestation that is extraordinary? I mean, in a sense, in terms of the numbers of people, the attention it gets, the media that arrives here, the art world that arrives here. I mean, is it something that is valuable and important and meaningful?
Well, I guess it's a classic example of new money attaching itself to old. This great kind of heavy tradition of European trade, which is Venice's, how Venice was built up. And the new international trade in contemporary art superimposed on the top, it's a perfect marriage. And a bit of validation both ways.
People are critical and say it's just a huge kind of trade fair. Is that problematic, or is that what it is? And is that important or an issue?
Well, I guess it was always a trade fair, but maybe things were a bit more naked. I mean, it's a trade, you know, like I said, it was a city based on trading, so that, you know, it makes sense. Although the trading is couched in a lot of historicity, so it kind of seems more rich, but it's only the same thing. And totally makes sense to me. And if you want something else, you can do something else somewhere else. That's what they do here.
Is there anything in particular that you've seen in the Biennale that's sort of memorable or grabbed you, that you think is kind of significant, that points in a direction that you hadn't kind of known about before?
I think a very good thing to learn is that video art can be very dull if you get bombarded with a lot of it. And I also liked the arse end of the Arsenale. It was actually the better part of the show. Well, I liked the Kabakov, the Chantal Akerman, Atom Egoyan video. But they kept those to the last, so that you had to work your way through a lot of other stuff to get there. And, you know, a lot of the other stuff was also very good. But it's good, bad. It's good, indifferent, and bad. And as this kind of state of the nation kind of idea, so I suppose it made sense. But it's a bit of a mangle to put anyone through who wants to look at art. But that's its function is not to, I suppose, to be concise, more to be comprehensive.
So your abiding memory from this Biennale, what will you go away with as the most significant image or memory in your mind?
Probably the kind of real reasons why a lot of people like to come here at this time of year. It's sun, water, friends, drinking, and a bit of art thrown in for good measure.
In that order?
It's a circle. It goes round and back again the other way.
So, Damien Hirst, we've met just outside Hotel Danieli.
No, don't think.
What about the 2001 Venice Biennale? Because we did actually record you a while ago, a few years ago. Liam Gillick taught you.
You're joking. I can't remember what I said with Liam. I'm on holiday, really.
But why are you actually here? Are you here in support of a particular project? Or
no, the reason why I'm here, really, is that my friend Keith, my boyfriend, Alan, is the godfather of my son, Connor. And we're kind of drifting apart. And then a friend, Michael Dew, a Korean artist, has got a piece in the Venice Pavilion, and I suddenly realised that I don't really like the art world, but I like art. And I suddenely realised that when I was there last time, you can actually have a lot of fun in Venice. So I came to mend my relationship with my boyfriend and also get drunk and have a great time and be on holiday and, you know, have some fun. And look at Michael Dew's installation.
Right, I mean,
Venice is for lovers.
But Venice Biennale is just becoming absolutely extraordinary. The number of people, the amount of attention, the explosion of interest in it. I mean, does that sort of worry you? Do you think it's a positive thing or what? It's virtually the whole of the international art world is here.
Yeah, but I think it makes it look like the Muppets and you can really enjoy yourself.
Sorry?
I think it makes you look like the Muppets and you can really enjoy yourself. It's like you. See, people are forced to smile at each other when they realise that they hate each other's guts, so it's great to kind of hang around and not have anything to do. I mean, I was working last time I was in Venice, but now I'm not. And Venice is a beautiful city with a lot of history, and, you know, so it's great to see all art galleries forced into tiny areas looking at each other and smiling and getting drunk and see, hopefully, a little bit of serious art, but not very much, I guess.
Some people say it's like a kind of a really, it's become just an international trade fair, really, and it ceased to be about art.
I'm not really here for that. I mean, I love art, but, you know, and it's good, you know, I know all the people. I've got a lot of friends in the art world, so it's a lot of fun.
Would you be interested in doing, you know, the British Pavilion at some point?
No, I turned it down 2 years ago. I mean, maybe later on. But, you know, I mean, if you've got the work, it's a lot of work. I mean, I'm interested in making art, but I think representing your country, I'm only 36, I think you need to be a bit older. You know, I can hardly fucking do this. I just want to go to the next bar and get drunk. What's it for, anyway?
Audio arts.
You know, okay, cool. No, it'd be funny.
One of the earlier issues and debates, before you were who you are in terms of public
profile. What do you mean who I am?
No, but do you remember we put your image of the fish on the front that Jay gave us?
Didn't you hear it? Yeah. No, I agree.
It goes back some time, so.
No. I'm not being awkward, but it's an interview and we're talking. It's fine, but yeah. And me, but it's like I was talking to you and you go, "Hi, Damien," it's really casual. Then you pick up the microphone and you go, "Hello, really,
how
long?"
It's just
but it'd be an interesting tape anyway, won't it?
Yeah.
Okay,
it's just a way of doing it.
Let's go to the restaurant. No, I love it. It's fine. I'll say anything.
But have you actually seen anything, Damien, in this Biennale that really interests you and impresses you?
Yes, Michael Dew's installation, but I only really came to.
Could I go around it? Sorry, I've got it.
Oh,
so,
sorry.
Is there anything you've seen here that really interests you and impresses you?
Yeah. This lady here, my sister, she's from Leeds. This is Elimere. She's very interesting. I've signed her. She's the most beautiful.
But what?
What?
Do you want to? Is there anything you have seen that's interested you?
I have only. I'm not lying. I'm not lying, honestly. I came to Venice to mend my relationship with my boyfriend, Keith Allen, and he's the godfather of my child. We left it too long, we split up, and There's some art here. I looked at some things, and I'm not lying. The only piece of artwork I looked at was Michael Jew's, and I've heard that it's not so good this year, and I haven't really looked, but I'm really here for a holiday, you know. And I've been trying to have holiday, and every time I go on holiday, I think about the art world, and I can't relax. And I sort of thought, fight fire with fire, go for holiday in the art world in Muppet Land and enjoy yourself. Please believe me.
Muppet Land because of what? Why do you call it Muppet Land?
Well, because when you see everybody together smiling and kissing when they hate each other and everything, and it seems ridiculous that the whole art world arrives in Blackheath type area. Now I'm becoming a man from Bombay. They look like the Muppets, basically. No, but honestly, that's the truth.
Yeah.
I came with Keith, to mend our relationship. Plus, I've got two children. It's great to get away and behave like a child yourself.
I don't know.
No, but I haven't come to look at the art, so I can't really talk about the art.
Right. So, you haven't seen any or...
I've only been to one pavilion, Michael Jew's.
Yeah.
And I think it's great.
Yeah.
But Michael asked me to come, and he's my friend. I've bought some of his pieces, so I came along. Yeah. I brought Keith, my other friend, and I've brought my sisters from Leeds, who, he's Italian, Leeds, from Chicago, California.
Yeah.
And, I didn't really come as an artist, so it's quite difficult. If you ask me what I think of the pavilions, I haven't seen them.
Right. Okay, well...
I've seen them.
What are they like? I heard this shit. Michael Jew's is good, that's all I know.
Yeah, right.
But listen to my voice. I've been drinking solidly for 4 days. And Venice is for lovers. I came to mend it up with my boyfriend. Where's Keith? Great.
No, I'm sorry
to have
you.
Oh, fantastic audio session. Definitely.
Well, it's what it is. I mean, audio art is always about just what it is, actuality.
Yep.
Georgina Starr at her Bunny Lake collection. Georgina, I'd like to talk to you first of all about the work we can hear.
Yeah.
This is an ongoing project that you've worked on for a number of years now.
Yeah.
I'd like to talk about first of all where the inspiration came from and also what you're doing in Venice with the fashion show.
Mm-hmm. Originally, the project did start about 2 years ago. It kind of was partly inspired by a movie called Bunny Lake is Missing, which is an Otto Preminger film from the 60s. And it's a film which I'd seen as a child, actually, and I'd been kind of quite terrified by it, because it's about a young girl who obviously goes missing, and she's called Bunny Lake, and she's a five-year-old girl. And throughout the film, you never see her. So my kind of memory of the film was just like the whole time my mother searching for her daughter and like not being able to find her, and there's all these other kind of plots with it kind of happening inside the film. But so a couple of years ago, it came into my head for some reason, and I'd kind of also made a comparison between the film and my own sister, because I'd actually watched the film with my sister, and my sister kind of has her character developed, kind of reminded me in some way of how I imagine Bunny Lake would have developed as going from being a child to an adult. But in the film, you never see Bunny Lake as an adult. It just ends when she's found. And I was just always totally fascinated by what would happen to Bunny Lake after the film had ended. How would she be as a young girl, as a teenager, and then as an adult? And so I'd kind of started kind of looking into the film, but I couldn't find it, which was kind of irritating for about a year. I found a book that was actually written... it's like the script for the film by Evelyn Piper, American writer. And then I'd kind of looked around for the film, couldn't find it. And then finally when I did see it, I didn't remember a certain part of the film, which was the ending of the film. I could never remember exactly what happened to Bunny. So what happened in the film was she was actually kidnapped by her mother's brother, because the brother felt betrayed by the sister because she loved her daughter more than she loved him. There was this sort of weird brotherly, sisterly kind of relationship going on within the film. And the kind of final scene, which is like the finale, which is what I hadn't remembered, was just amazing. Like, basically, Bunny is, you see him in the garden, a walled kind of garden, you see him run out to the car, open the boot of his car, and Bunny is laid in the car. So finally, he found out she's alive. And he kind of takes her out and walks into the garden, and he's going to bury her alive. So it's this really traumatic kind of thing, and that had really kind of, I mean, seeing the film again as an adult, that kind of this sort of torturous experience, you know, of like this child who's going to be buried alive, it kind of, I thought it's kind of an interesting start to kind of make him work.
Can you just talk a little bit about how you're going to have this big performance tomorrow?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah.
And you're going to have, after that, the installation with the costumes. Can we talk a little bit about the costumes and the whole putting together of this in Venice and this big show you're going to have?
The costumes originally kind of came from me designing these outfits for the Bunny Lakes. I'd started making these clothes as a sort of, like I said before, as a sort of uniform for the Bunny Lakes. But then I'd kind of got very interested in more elaborate sort of costumes that weren't necessarily for kids. They were more kind of like dresses that say, I mean, at the time, as well as being interested in the Bunny Lake film, there was another movie called Targets, which has kind of been really influential in the making of this work. And that has a scene set at a drive-in at the end. It's about this guy who basically goes on a killing spree in LA, and he ends up in a drive-in movie theatre, and he hides behind the screen and basically uses the people in cars as targets, and he kills. So again, it's this sort of horrific kind of thing, and he's very similar to the brother character in Bunny Lake Is Missing. He's a young man who feels betrayed by society. He's kind of hates his life, and he feels that by, you know, killing people, he's just basically getting something back. You know, it is, again, a sort of retribution kind of thing. And then I was just, again, when I saw the kind of how these two films for me kind of fitted together, was just, not just the characters, but also this kind of violence that's inexplicable. There's no explanation for the violence that happens in the movie. And even at the end, when he gets caught, there's no explanation why he did it. You know, you're just left wondering. And I think with the fashion show, when I started making these dresses, I always saw the models as being a little bit like the people in the cars at the drive-in. They were, like, kind of innocent, and they were perfect targets, you know, because, like, they were just sat, I mean, watching a movie, you feel like you are kind of vulnerable. You just kind of, what, you're kind of in this movie, and you sat there, and especially in a car, you feel very comfortable, and kind of you're in this little enclosed shell, and you're kind of, you know, totally immersed in a movie. And I think with the fashion models, I thought, in a way, they're kind of this similar thing. They're kind of like this vulnerable, kind of almost victims, and they were coming out, like, as fashion models do, on a catwalk. You know, they're a bit like at the fun fair, you know, when you're shooting cams or whatever. And I just saw them as this, the kind of the perfect, I mean, the perfect way where the Bunny Lakes could kind of appear again. I was very interested in the Bunny Lakes appearing again in another situation, another event. And then, so I've been making these dresses. I've actually made the performance already in Geneva. I made it in October at a gallery called Pink Summer there. I made the same dresses, and what happens, should I say what happens at the in the video? Right, so this is going to come out after, so it's okay. What happens is it's a normal fashion show. It's just an event, you know, so the models come out in these beautiful dresses, but they're all white, a bit like victims almost in horror movies. You know, I mean, I've been watching a lot of Dario Argento films, and he's just, the women are always beautiful and in white, because white shows the blood the best. And so all the dresses I've designed are all white and silver, but each of the dresses has some sort of, it's kind of like a bit of it's kind of saying something like what maybe is going to happen. You know, it's got this little key to kind of what, like the violence that maybe is going to happen afterwards. Some of the dresses have little red feathers coming out of them. Some have sort of slashes and cuts, like wounds.
So the symbolism again, how you see in films where a little bit speck of red wine goes on the dress or something, and you know that something awful's going to happen.
So you kind of know that something's up. You know, that they look kind of beautiful, but at the same time, there's just these little kind of details that you kind of, you know that maybe something is, you know, some sort of impending violence or whatever is going to happen. Anyway, so in the catwalk show, I mean, in Genoa, how it works, which I hope it's going to work in Venice, is the audience arrive, and they're basically coming to see some dresses that I've designed, you know, and so they're all kind of sat watching the fashion show. And the music is, there's three different tracks. The first track is a track by Suicide, a band, and it's called Girl, Oh Girl, and this kind of gets you in the mood. The very kind of sexy young girls walking down the catwalk, and then at a certain point the music changes, and the strobe light will come on, and the music changes to a kind of very fast guitar kind of thrashy track that I made with a composer called David Benke. And then suddenly, from nowhere, the Bunny Lakes appear, and in this sort of incarnation, the Bunny Lakes are small children aged about 5 or 6. And they're all wearing these, again, perfectly white, pristine outfits with little white bonnets. and they're all carrying guns.
And the little white bonnets are furry, aren't they?
Yeah, the little furry bonnets. Little furry, so again, bunny kind bonnets. Of, yeah, referring against sort of the idea of bunny being a real bunny, but yeah, not kind of, there's no ears involved. And so the kids arrive, and basically they shoot the models dead on the catwalk, and then the as soon as they've done their job, they escape and they're gone. So you kind of don't know where they came from and you don't know where they've gone. And what's left is this sort of massacre of
and there's no
of
explanation.
Girls. There's no explanation, no. Because not only do they get shot, they get kind of splattered because there's lots of blood on the dresses. And I felt like the blood kind of finished the dresses off. For me, that was part of making the dresses. And they were only finished when they'd been killed. And so tomorrow we'll... I mean, I'm redoing it and it's just... Hopefully it'll go as well as it did in Genoa. But
and the costumes will also be on display. With the
after the piece is finished, I'll have the video projected in the space, and like there's a catwalk here in the room, and it's and the catwalk will stay there, and the dresses that have been kind of finished off with the blood will be on the catwalk, just laid on the catwalk, and so as you walk in the space, you'll see the actual video that's from the performance.
I'm here with Terry Smith in his studio to talk about Unnatural Acts, which you showed recently in Venice, Terry. Can we talk about both what's happening on the screen in front of us, mm-hmm. but also how it came about that you showed the work at Nova Icona, and a little bit about the background to the making of the piece?
Well, the piece was really began about 4 years ago, just playing with ideas about taking things apart and undoing things. It's one of those ideas that just stay on the shelf for a while. Then I got a commission to make a video project for a museum in Mexico City, Ex Teresa, which is a deconsecrated church. And this video, which is called Unnatural Acts, seemed to me to be a fitting piece for that location. The idea was to have a three-screen piece that was stacked one above the other.
When you say stacked on monitors or on actual screens?
On projections.
Yeah, on projections.
Straight onto the wall.
Yeah.
But when I got to Mexico, it was clear that technically we couldn't get the three screens to be synced together. I had a kind of idea that might be the case, so we re-edited the three screens into one screen, and that was the same version, more or less, I showed in Venice.
The person who's in the video is unravelling string, playing with foam, unravelling a video. In the past, you haven't worked with video yourself. What started you working with video? Why did you start working with that as a medium?
It goes right back to the first things I ever did as a kid. My dad had a standard date camera. So when I was 12, 13, I used this to make films. So I've been using moving image before I did anything else. And I always, you know, wanted to go back to it at some point, but never found the right reason, the right way of doing it. So in the last few years, I've been able to, you know, think about video.
In this piece, this kind of unravelling, or here we're watching a camera which is just being clicked through the film, the video is being unravelled, the string. Where's that coming from, this need to take these things to bits and unravel them in front of your audience?
There is a fascination, I think, for wanting to know how things operate, how the world operates. And sometimes you think, well, if I can undo it, I'll find out the secret of it. When I undid the radio, I had no idea how the radio worked. To me, it's still a mystery. You know, how was it music coming out of this thing? And you go into and look at the vowels, and nothing gives you the story. Nothing tells you in there why it works.
Where did you actually shoot this video?
I shot this in Andrew Galitis' house in Hackney. He's got a wonderful loft space. I wanted to have the camera a long way away from the action and have the lens pulled in, so we had a closed depth of field. So there had to be a space that was big enough to have the camera a long way away from where the table actually was.
Is Venice a very different experience from exhibiting elsewhere? I mean, that whole kind of making the piece for a certain place and thinking about how it's going to work. And I think you mentioned to me that it isn't there for the whole duration of the exhibition. Was it just on for the first week?
Yeah, I mean, because we made the show in a theatre. And we couldn't hire a theatre for the whole 5-6 months, so it was going to be a one-off thing. To me, there was no difference really, because my work is always about location and place. So whether it was Venice, or whether it was Mexico, whether it was Leytonstone, it doesn't really matter the difference. You know, it's relevant to that place. It was great to show in Venice. You see in quite clear focus how the kind of art world operates. It's like a shopping mall. You don't have to go to Venice, in fact, because these shows will come to a gallery near you in the next 2 years. You know that. And it's kind of appallingly lazy that that's what happens, you know, that what you see in museums around the world or what people have seen in Venice.
Were you struck by how many artists were using film or video in Venice this year? And what would be your kind of comment on that? Do you think there is a problem with some of the much longer pieces?
I think it helps if it tells you on the door the duration of the piece, because you know how to judge how much time you can spend with it. There's an awful lot of bad video there. There's only a few things that I liked, really.
Even what work did you find particularly?
I can't remember the name, but there's one sort of a, just a shot of a destitute man in the church who was falling asleep. Just one shot of them as they were kind of struggling, as their body was struggling to keep upright, and they were kind of wobbling to one side and the other. And I watched that for a while, and that was beautiful.
I'm here with Kerith Wynne-Evans to talk about his intervention at the Venice Biennale in the art newspaper. Kerith, I wanted to relate primarily what you did with your whole ideas of coding, metaphors, the way that you've worked in text and image in the past, and how this came about to do this intervention and what prompted you to do it in the particular way that you did.
Well, the whole idea came about because it was suggested to me by curator Rachel Thomas. In a way, I suppose we were looking for a space that coincided with Venice, but in a sense then wasn't a physical space, wasn't a building, in a sense. So the space became a space in a journal, and that journal, we were given a space, actually, or we suggested that we could make a space, a contribution within the art newspaper. Now, as far as I know, it's not something which has had a precedent within that journal, and those who know the art newspaper will understand that it's, to a certain extent, then a sort of trade magazine. You know, it's a trade rag, really. It's a sort of newspaper that the insiders of the art world buy, and it sort of relates gossip, and it relates auction house figures, and it relates news that's interested to the people who are in within the kind of business, in a sense. So that was a very particular context, and it was interesting for me to then examine what that context was and then work within that, as it were. So in a sense, had it been in another magazine, had it been in another kind of space, then I suppose the results would have been different. So there was something very much about the nature of the art newspaper that made the conditions of the piece what they are. What I eventually did was look at previous issues. So in a sense, you don't sort of look at it in the same kind of way as you might look at it if you were going to do something with it. And so instead of taking a page and putting some kind of picture or image or an illustration of a previous work into that, I felt it would be more appropriate to then sort of slip inside that context and try and do something which was on the threshold of visibility within that. And since the initial kind of impetus behind the project was, in a sense, then to look at issues of nationalisms, look at issues of identity, look at the problematics of how the Biennale, its history is sort of structured around notions of national representations. So when you have the Giardini, you have these various pavilions, always struck me as being rather problematic that, well, even the appearance and the design of the pavilions, in some almost stereotypical or cartoon sense, comes to represent the various national traits. So, for instance, you have this rather, well, to my mind, ugly neoclassical building that represents Britain. It looks like a mini version of the British Museum or something like that. You know, you have a rather elegant and clean and pure space, which is the Nordic Pavilion. They reaffirm certain cartoon traits, a bit like being in fancy dress or something. The thing that I felt would be interesting to do would be to confront that, possibly in a slightly confrontational way. This idea then of the Welsh language, it is my first language. I was born in Wales. It's not a joking matter, actually. It's a very important thing. It's a very sort of fundamental thing for me on all sorts of levels. the appreciation that I have of other cultures, of other languages, because I grew up through a process of translation, a dual understanding of various fundamental concepts of what it is to be able to communicate with other people. So in a sense, in a slightly cheeky way, I found something and I was looking for things that might trigger a sort of Welsh response, if you like, and it came in the most unusual form, because we found a page in a previous issue which spoke about the insecurities which major auction houses have in the West about China is about to enter the World Trade Organization, which will involve major auction houses losing money because they no longer have the monopoly on trading in Chinese antiquities. The thing which was the trigger was the title of the piece. So you've got a page in probably one of the most boring parts of the art newspaper right at the back, which talks about prices and auction houses and whatever, which says, "When the dragon awakes," which refers to the Chinese emblem of the dragon. Also, immediately on reading that, it made me think of the Welsh dragon, which is also the national emblem of Wales, and which is the Draigoch, the red dragon, which is on the flag. So in a sense, it conflated a certain sense of stereotypic nationalisms, because we're looking at certain very potent and very loaded historical and social and cultural symbols. And I suppose it's the first time that I ever thought about the Chinese dragon and the Welsh dragon in the same breath, if you can think a breath. Those gaps between language, recognition, interpretation, the spaces in between, the space which is a breath between, you know, a syllable or two words or whatever. So we're talking about what Duchamp would call an infra-thin space to work in here. So we're looking at spaces which are narrow spaces. So in a sense, then, what I tried to do, and it was exciting for me also because the page wasn't just for art newspaper information, it also had two ads at the bottom, which were, in fact, ads for auction houses, and I believe somewhere in Stockholm and somewhere in, I forget now where exactly, but so the idea would be then to very directly and as efficiently as possible translate the entire page, keeping absolutely everything in place, but just to make a literal translation of the page from the previous issue and publish it in the next one. Now, one of the things that was also on another level of intriguing to me was the fact that the auction houses that had these ads for, one was a Guido Reni painting, another was an Henri Michaud drawing or whatever it was, the auctions would have passed by that time. So to a certain extent, then there was this sort of capsule revival of some information, and in a way it was interesting to not merely take the simplistic play of saying dragon, dragon, and the cheeky thing of twisting information into a certain shape where very, very few people would understand what that was or have access to it in that language. But also, in a sense, then, the whole page took on a material property of being a translated ready-made, if you like. So it was about those things of pointing out that nationalisms, regionalisms, localisms within the context of Venice, since the art newspaper was being launched during the Biennale, was an albeit slightly subtle or possibly even invisible pointer towards these kinds of issues, you know, where the whole art world or a great deal of the art world converge on Venice for this carnival, this kind of circus, actually, which happens every 2 years, and just the infighting and the bitchiness and the money involved. I sent someone an email the other day. They said, "Oh, where have you been?" And I said, "I've been in Venice. You know, it's so marvelous." I said, "The deception, the masks, the masquerades, you know," and I said, "and that's just the art world." Somehow Venice every 2 years gets to fulfill this kitsch tacky thing and the art world gets to show off a bit. That's not to say that there weren't great things to see there, of course, but, you know, I've sort of got better things to do than queue for 3 hours in order to see someone's installation in a national pavilion, you know, so there's that sort of pressure also. Venice is a kind of mixed blessing, I think. The show travels also. It's a convention which happens in a newspaper, so the life of the newspaper is also, to a certain extent, then the life of the work. But in a way, I mean, I think the work, it's sort of something buried. It's a bit like some kind of junk bit of genetic code which you choose to put a picture into or something like that. This notion of the work being, in a sense, encoded, you know, in a sense, buried within the larger meaning, that there's layers in the cake, there's one layer which is this one particular thing, which is a strand that runs through something. one of the first works I ever made when I became a student at St. Martin's. I made fake pebbles, and I took them down to Brighton on the train and hid them on the beach. The moment you put these things down on the beach, they become instantly invisible. But in fact, they were handcrafted and sort of polished, and I made them as absolutely pebble-like as they could possibly be. So in a sense, the work hasn't changed from that time. You know, there's a certain level of playful subversion. I mean, this is one of the things that impresses me so much about the situationist writer Guy Debord. Is he says, some of us are at war with the world, but some of us take that lightly. Taking it lightly is still a strategy that's appealing to me. Of course, it produces these incessant anecdotes that keeps me going and makes me still a social being.
Rachel, you're a curator at the Mead Gallery, and it was you who persuaded Kerith, in fact, to get involved in this intervention. I'd like to talk a little bit, because I know you've got a lot of ideas about this and what you were trying to do and how you feel that's been fulfilled or not, as the case may be. So if we could talk a little bit about what you conceived this idea, how you conceived this idea, and what you were trying to do by actually producing this intervention.
Well, as Venice becomes, I think, slicker each year, everybody becomes more sort of into their own cliche of national identity within that. I had a conversation with a few colleagues about what Wales was representing for that year, and the feedback was, well, if there's a project that comes off the ground, let's sort of try and get something working towards it. But there is a lack of, I think, of support towards various projects and towards actually housing a Welsh pavilion, because it takes lots of money, lots of corporate sponsorship. As Venice becomes more corporate-led too, this idea of art within walls becomes even more fixed and more ground. So then I flew up the idea of actually doing something which is actually breaks away the red tape, that actually goes beyond the corporate buying and selling of artworks, the commodification, that it can be a ready-made that you can have, and something which is like going beyond the white cube, which is that 90 concept, let's go beyond that. And so a text piece was originally what I had in mind, or an object. And the perfect match, which was only my main suggestion, was actually Kerith. Knowing his work, knowing that he does actually question boundaries, he questions sort of various meanings. That idea of investigation within a piece was very much why I wanted Kerith within that stage. So we did talk very early on of, you know, interested in doing a work and a piece, and also an artwork that everybody could take away with them, because the actual intervention is a great artwork as well. So this sort of grew momentum within that, and the art newspaper, I was really astounded initially, and the British Council, who said, right, you can distribute from the British pavilion, we're really engaged within this project. And if anything, I'm actually kicking myself, because if I'd done this a few months earlier, this actual intervention could have grew bigger and bigger. But we just thought, let's do it, almost like in the spirit of the Manchester pavilion, let's get this going, because if it goes for two more years for the next pavilion, then we're going to be out of time. So I really think we achieved quite a lot by doing this. Firstly, that this artwork got there in time within the art newspaper, was distributed, people were aware of it. Secondly, it raises really important and actually quite radical questions about what's going on with the Welsh Pavilion and also the Arts Council of Wales, which I have been in contact with. They were initially going to support it, but now waiting for the next Welsh sort of presence in the next 2 years of the Venice Biennale. So for me, it does raise issues of what is it to be a Welsh artist as well? What is it to talk about national identity? Are we going for the cliché-ridden, I'm representing Wales, in a picture book of certain... Sorry, I stopped there.
Yeah, we're not. This is turning into a complete literary.
Don't rain on my parade, okay?
I know, my eyes are as
wide as... Look. And you're crying.
I think we're going to have to go into the corridor. I think we're just going to... This is hilarious, Phil. We are being so rained on. My eyes are completely watering. It's just...
Publish
we're
the whole
really...
thing as it is.
I mean, this is just amazing. I'm going to put this in my bag.
It's okay to continue.
We're now inside, having been rain-stopped clay. So if there are any odd things on the tape, it's because we're in a completely different acoustic space. Do you want to carry on, Rachel?
Yes, sorry, my brain went blank earlier. Using the tradition of Dan Graham's work as well, he inserted sort of an advertisement within Harper's and Queen and Americans at Harper's Bazaar as well. And that really linked into Kerry's work, that we thought by inserting it within the art newspaper, we would actually question what we're doing, that we're not actually doing a two-dimensional work of art. When we haven't got an agenda of selling this piece, our agenda is actually to raise issues about cultural identity, global boundaries, and also the uses of language. I think language is something which, you know, as the Venice goes more towards installation-based art, less towards two-dimensional work, that the written word itself, I think, is actually being overlooked lots of times. So I think that issue of actually looking at just the simplicity of translation, that very much that act of reinscribing language, I think we are raising questions there. And obviously the big question of Wales, to me, is something very personal to my heart, that I thought, you know, we need to actually raise awareness. And because of that, actually, key members of Arts Council, key members of the steering committee have actually come to me because of our intervention within Venice. And I think we have actually succeeded in raising these issues quite successfully, so they will be noted. And actually I'm part of the steering committee now for the next for the Welsh Pavilion for the next Venice Biennale. So I think we have succeeded on quite a few levels, actually.
Suna, I've just heard you make a presentation about the opening of the Baltic project. We're in Palazzo Sonova. First of all, tell me your primary purpose in coming to Venice to make this presentation.
We wanted to do it in four stages, so we started with the building in Gateshead a few weeks ago. So we invited, of course, national and regional press to that, and to have an opportunity to see the building. So that made sense to start with the building, because the building is very, very much the Baltic for the moment. And then we wanted to do one international, which is now in Venice, and of course it makes sense as well, because everyone is here. And since Baltic will be an international centre, we need to do these international connections. Then we do one press launch in London and one in Edinburgh. And, I mean, those two press launches will then cover, hopefully, the national audience and presses, and the wider regional. So it, and then, of course, spreading the word wherever. So we are quite a few from the staff going down for this. I feel it's very, very important for us, because it will be, as I said, an international centre, and we will definitely work with international partners, similar to what I did in Malmö Konsthall, where I had 10 to 12 really, really strong international partners, and we produced lots of interesting things together.
So that idea of partnership is obviously important, because there are models of regional places and galleries that don't seem to ever penetrate beyond the region, but you see it as part of a network of international facilitators and collaborators.
It is, definitely. I mean, to me, art has absolutely nothing to do with geography. It's all about quality. So, I mean, if there is a very good artist in Gateshead or Newcastle, I will definitely show this person, but I will also show international art. So we will judge from how important it is for the centre and for our audiences, of course. We are in Palazzo Zanobio, and we are more or less hosted by Van Abbe Museum in Eindhoven, which is a very interesting government-funded museum in the south of Holland. And we were looking for a partner in Venice where we could host us and where we could be. And since I know Jan de Bout, the director of Van Abbe, for long, he said, why not do it in our exhibition? So this is the Dutch alternative exhibition to connect it to the pavilion, the Dutch pavilion, but it's completely free. And we just wanted to do it where... But it also made another sense, because in this show... one of the artists is Marijke van Bermadam, a Dutch artist, filmmaker, and we commissioned her last year to do a piece for Grey Street in Newcastle, and that piece is also shown now in Venice. So we had this connection already, which made sense, of course. So Marijke is the connection between us and the Dutch people for this pavilion. We could have chosen the Swedish, of course, or we could have chosen others, but it's just how it happened, and it's a beautiful place to be.
And let's talk a little bit about the actual opening of Baltic. What will happen? I mean, what artists will you present? I mean, it will be an ongoing process, because you'll have artists in residence and so on. So it's not going to be programmed perhaps in a conventional model, as a conventional model of a gallery.
No, what I really would like the Baltic opening to be is to just open the doors and there is the place. So it's not just starting from absolutely nothing. So we would like to invite the arts in residence, publishers in residence, writers in residence, curators in residence already before the opening, and then they will be a part of the process leading up to the 9th of March next year. But it's also the main purpose is actually to show that how the artists take possession of the building. That's what I would like to give the impression. So it's not just the Baltic show and this and that artist, but it's more they are taking possession. It's their place, and this should be shown as a place for artists.
Finally, coming back to where we are, I mean, we're at the 2001 Venice Biennale. Do you have any sense of what's important about this year's event? It's certainly extraordinarily popular in terms of the pressure of people here. I mean, it really, I've never seen anything like it in terms of the crowds of journalists and international curators. Is there something in all that that's significant, do you think, that we should all take notice of?
I think we should, and I wouldn't say I'm worried, but I'm surprised and slightly worried, of course, that the contemporary art attracts those crowds. I mean, 5 million people to Tate Modern, and Venice Biennale is so crowded you can hardly walk around. I mean, it's strange because contemporary art has never really been popular, and it's very difficult to make it popular. But there is something about around it now that it's slightly worrying with me. It's this celebrity focus on not just the art, but also the artists. And I think that art needs to be anchored in something more than just a celebrity, because then the whole system is just using the artist as a kind of consuming the artist, and this is the brand for this year, and then it goes away. And I would very much like it to be a little bit more substantial. Of course, out of all this, there will be something, I mean, staying and being classical and so on as well. But I don't think that we ever had this before. And I am worried because there are lots of things making the contemporary art popular, and all these major sponsors now coming in. So it could be actually be a vicious circus where the sponsors are more and more choosing what to be seen. And then we are really on thin ice, I think.
Well, now I'm at the Manchester Pavilion in Venice with Pavel Buchler. Pavel, as I say, we're at the Manchester Pavilion. The first question I'd like to ask you is, why the Manchester Pavilion? Because you are the inaugurator of this project in Venice at the 2001 Biennale. So why did you feel it was important to have a Manchester Pavilion?
To have a Manchester Pavilion per se is not important. The question of importance the question of importance concerns the issue of what you can do how you can make a contribution to a Biennale in Venice. Does Venice need more art? Probably not. Does it need another late-night drinking place? Probably yes. How do you get people to find that place? Well, you call it a Manchester Pavilion, a pavilion.
One of the topics that we discussed at the round table yesterday was the issue of how it is that so many new countries want to have a presence in Venice. And, I mean, I think you are a new country, if you like, or you're a new presence. And, I wondered if you could really define what you feel the reason for that is, why this event seems to be attractive as a place that you wanted to come to.
Well, the first thing is maybe we should worry a little bit less about the countries about the countries that have no pavilions, and maybe worry a little bit more about the pavilions that have no countries, like my old country's pavilion, Czechoslovakia, a pavilion without a country. But the direct answer to your question is that obviously the existence of national pavilions gives you a precedent which kind of allows you, if you like, to place yourself in this kind of, you know, strange sort of melange of identities that the Biennale is, by simply you know, declaring your geographic identity or geopolitical identity, you know, the first city pavilion, there you go, and you become part of it.
Charles Asia described the Venice Biennale as a charming anachronism, which I certainly find problematic because it's much more than that. But here we are. I've never seen a Biennale with so many people here. People want to belong to it, want to embrace it, want to be part of it. But Manchester isn't a country, obviously. But you've made an intervention, in fact, which is a bar that we can hear in the background. So what made you choose this particular strategy?
The Biennale is a place where you kind of want to be. It's in a beautiful city. There are, you know, wonderful people around like yourself. It's a great opportunity to come and see people. It's actually a good opportunity to come and see some art as well and so on.
I got the idea of the last night. I forgot. Michael from Chelsea. Love it. Yeah. But you didn't. I can't remember what you said. You